Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
These discussions with paramilitaries were at play with death.
Remarkable personal stories from around the world.
They don't speak with words, they speak with guns.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and at 13 hours GMT on Wednesday, the 24th of April, these are our main stories. America's top diplomat is visiting China with a warning against support for Russia. President Biden promises more weapons for Ukraine after the Senate approved a multi-billion dollar aid package. And Australian police arrest seven teenagers in counter-terrorism operations. Also in this podcast, its bosses say they lead a sustainable company, but now Brazil Iron has been taken to court over its environmental record.
This was a lake 3 meters deep where we had a project to raise fish. After the mine started extracting there, waste came down. It fell into the spring.
And did artificial intelligence help to discover the grave of the father of Western philosophy? The status of Taiwan, the war in Ukraine, the situation in the Middle East, just some of the issues the world's two biggest economies, the US and China, don't agree on. So it's not going to be an easy trip for the US Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who's in China for key talks. While Mr. Blinken was on his way to Shanghai, Congress in Washington approved a major US foreign aid package, which included more help for Taiwan, and that's angered the Chinese. Here's their foreign ministry spokesman, Wang Wenbin.
I'd like to emphasize that the strengthening of military ties between the United States and Taiwan will not bring about security for Taiwan, nor can it save the doomed fate of Taiwan independence. It will only increase tensions and the risk of conflict across the Taiwan Strait, and will ultimately be an act of shooting oneself in the foot.
Our China correspondent Laura Bicker says the issue of Taiwan remains a major sticking point between the US and Beijing.
For China, it is a red line. They see the self-governing island as part of China and that the United States should not get involved. And the latest aid package, they say, is a betrayal of that policy. They say that it will encourage separatism within Taiwan and they will push against it strongly. So I think that will be the key message from Beijing's side.
Lots on Mr. Blinken's agenda, Laura, including trying to warn China off getting involved in Russia's war in Ukraine.
China says it is not giving any weapons to Russia, and certainly they say they have not given any weapons since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But the US says that China is providing components in its trade with Russia that Russia could use as weapons. They want that to stop. And they want to find a way for China to work with Washington to persuade Russia to come to the table and look at peace talks. So I think that's one thing on Antony Blinken's agenda that will be pretty tough for China and the United States to get on the same page about.
And just stepping back from the specifics, how do you assess the state of US-China relations right now?
I think both sides are trying to take steps towards one another. These are very tentative steps. And every time they take a step forward, something else comes along to kind of derail them from their path. I think it's going to be very difficult for both sides to find a way to work together. But they are managing to find bright spots. Climate change, they can work together on climate change issues. But when it comes to trade, when it comes to Taiwan, the South China Sea, the Middle East and Ukraine, all these big issues, taking steps towards one another is very, very difficult. But the world wants these two superpowers to find a way. And both of them do want to come to some agreement. For the United States, it's about finding a way to work with China as well as compete with China. And for China, they want American businesses to come and thrive here. So there are common interests there. It's just finding a way to get to it.
Our China correspondent Laura Bicker with me from Beijing. The United States Senate has approved three major aid packages for Ukraine, Israel and Taiwan. President Joe Biden said the deals, which total almost $100 billion, show his country stands against tyranny and oppression. He said more military assistance will be sent to Ukraine within days after he signs the legislation into law. The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer praised the passing of the bill.
This is an inflection point in history. Western democracy faces perhaps the greatest test since the end of the Cold War, and this supplemental is essential to meeting the challenges. Failure to pass the supplemental would have been a gift to Putin, to Iran, to Xi, and hurt America politically, militarily, economically, and culturally. I'm glad that when it mattered most, finally, both parties came together to do the right thing for our nation's security.
Our North America correspondent Peter Bowes told us the bill was passed despite opposition from some Republicans.
This was a long time in coming, held up for months, in large part by Republicans in the House, some of whom would rather see more money spent here in the United States on immigration and on the issues affecting the southern border of the US with Mexico. But there does seem to have been a change of heart amongst some Republicans, notably the Speaker of the House, which allowed it to pass through that stage of that part of Congress at the weekend. Now rubber stamped, you could say, or at least passed in the upper house, the Senate as well. Just remains for it to be signed into law by President Biden, and the President already issuing a statement indicating that that military aid that President Zelensky in Ukraine has said that is so desperately needed, that military aid will be on the way, we're told, by the end of this week. Defense weaponry in particular that is so desperately needed. That's part of the $61 billion package for Ukraine. Then there's $26 billion for Israel, also humanitarian aid for the people of Gaza, and about $8 billion for Taiwan to stave off potential advances by China and some of the issues in the Indo-Pacific region. One of the measures in this bill, perhaps most controversial for some Americans at least, is the potential ban on TikTok. And this is part of the security measure that is part of this very large bill, with essentially an ultimatum to ByteDance, which is the company, the Chinese company that owns TikTok, that they should divest and sell the platform to an American owner or face a ban in this country. Now, nothing is really going to happen quickly. It's quite likely that ByteDance will take this to the courts, claim that this move is unconstitutional, and also suggest that the concerns of Americans are misplaced, or the concerns of Washington are misplaced, and that is that the Chinese government could invoke security measures to in some way get hold of the personal data of Americans that is part of that app. ByteDance likely to say that they've already taken measures to ensure that that doesn't happen.
Our North America correspondent Peter Bowes. So how has this news gone down in Kyiv, especially in view of new Russian missile attacks on Ukraine's second city, Kharkiv, during the night? Our Ukraine correspondent is James Waterhouse.
It's two hurdles out of three cleared now for this enormous $60 billion military package coming from America. President Zelensky has described the US as being a beacon for the free world and almost cementing itself as a major supporter of democracy. He's once again extended his thanks to the US Senate on this occasion, but we've seen a change in tone from him, really, where with his evening addresses and when he speaks at press conferences, of late he's been sort of pleading for help. But now he's planning. He's very much in planning mode. He's announcing different defence contracts being drawn up. Most of this package will involve ammunition, missiles, shells, air defence systems, which will allow Ukraine to sort of reignite its war, potentially. But I think what's widely accepted is that the goal for 2024 is simply to try and hold the line once more, to try and stop these Russian advances before, in the hopes of Kyiv, shaping for more liberations next year. But Ukraine has been here before. A counteroffensive has been talked up before. And what Russia has proven is that it can hold on to what it has taken. So I think we're in a week where it's been significant for Ukraine in a diplomatic sense, in that this is a huge moment, the return of America, which keeps Ukraine in this fight. But it also extends the duration of what has been a gruelling war.
But it's interesting to think that even this sort of amount of money, tens of billions of dollars, may not be enough to have a game-changing effect on the conflict, just to, you know, hold Russia at bay for a bit longer.
This is the fact of the battlefield, really, where in the 6 months of political delays in Washington, we have seen Russia continue with its so-called meat-grinder tactics of launching wave after wave of soldiers to try and take as much Ukrainian territory as possible. And crucially for Ukraine, settlements have fallen. Towns like Avdiivka and more villages, places that are continually reduced to rubble, and it brings other cities into the firing line. So to change that when your back is facing the enemy, if you like, and where you have Ukrainian forces building new defensive lines, new trenches, that takes time to turn around. The former head of the armed forces here said for the deadlock to be broken, several innovations need to happen at once, being it technological, the use of drones, weapons manufacturing, smart military thinking.
And from James Waterhouse in Kyiv to Berlin. British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has been greeted with officials and military honours on his way to a meeting with the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz. Ukraine and the Middle East on the agenda, of course, but Mr Sunak also touched on the issue of defence spending.
We stand here today together as the leading defence spenders in Europe, unshakable NATO allies and the two largest military supporters of Ukraine in Europe. And together we will continue to provide unwavering support for our Ukrainian friends, as you said, for as long as it takes.
I asked our Berlin correspondent, Jessica Parker, what else had come out of that news conference?
Yeah, I mean, it was a pretty friendly news conference. Both men actually attempting each other's language at one point. Rishi Sunak saying, mein Freund, as he addressed Olaf Scholz, the Chancellor here in Berlin. And look, the main issue, as expected, that they talked about and were asked about was defence. Lots of compliments going back and forth about things that Germany's done to help Ukraine, things that the UK has done to help Ukraine. But of course, actually, this is all the sort of diplomatic nicety. But there have been tensions in the past about respective aid. So, for example, Germany still refusing to send Taurus cruise missiles to Ukraine. Olaf Scholz reiterating again today when asked that he wasn't going to send those long-range missiles. I think when you speak to officials in private, to the Brits' frustration. And then, of course, Rishi Sunak announcing 2.5% spending target for UK by the end of the decade yesterday puts a bit of pressure on Germany. But, I mean, they've only just hit 2% themselves this year for the first time since the early 90s. But look, that being said, I think there was a big effort to show unity for Ukraine, send a message to President Putin, and I think also send a message across the Atlantic as well that Europe is starting to really take its defence and security seriously.
So Britain and Germany are big contributors to Ukraine and are spending a large amount of public money here with these announcements, but it's dwarfed by what's just come from the US.
Yeah, I mean, the US is by a country mile. When you look at things like the Kiel Institute that sort of tracks donation pledges, is far out ahead, but this $60 billion package of aid for Ukraine obviously got stuck in Congress for months. And that was very bad news for Kyiv. Obviously, they've been struggling on the battlefield against Russia. But I think it also probably sharpened the challenge here in Europe and the stark realization that, and some leaders speak about this more openly than others, they were pretty diplomatic again today about, for example, the prospect of a Trump presidency going forward. But I think it does make European leaders realise that they need to be more self-reliant, not just in terms of supporting Ukraine, but also just supporting themselves. There was a pretty unfavourable report recently about the state of Germany's armed forces. So there's a wide recognition here that there's much more that Germany needs to do. And of course, not just about spending large sums of money. It's about spending it well and countries in the NATO military alliance looking at each other's different capacities, which is why these countries have to keep talking about exactly what they're doing and what they're spending the money on.
Jessica Parker with me from Berlin. Campus protests in the United States against the war in Gaza have spread from Columbia and Yale to other universities as officials attempt to calm a growing and in part aggressive movement. On Monday, police broke up a demonstration at New York University and made dozens of arrests. The university said it received reports of intimidating chants and anti-Semitic incidents. Protest groups say their criticism is not anti-Semitic and is reserved for the Israeli state and its supporters. Here's our North America editor, Sarah Smith.
When police clashed with students outside New York University and arrested over 100 of them when they wouldn't leave, it created another flashpoint in the spreading pro-Palestinian campus protests. In the beautiful spring sunshine, the NYU students took up their placards once again to show their defiance. Esma Benghazia is a protest organiser who described to me what happened.
The police brutality was egregious and extraordinary. Police officers have arrested students, maced them. There were students there with medical challenges and disabilities.
Some Jewish students have complained that the protests are intimidating and say they have faced harassment and anti-Semitism on campus.
I'm scared to wear a Jewish star here. I've gotten very nasty anti-Semitic comments at me, and I just don't understand how this is accepted.
Free Palestine!
Many of the protesters in New York are wearing COVID-style masks to hide their faces because they say they've been bullied online if they've been recognised. Dylan is a demonstrator who didn't want to give his surname for the same reason.
We are facing very good, very well-organized Zionist agitators, right, who weaponize their claim of Jewishness in order to shut down what is legitimate protest.
Accusations of intolerance from both sides are a common feature of these demonstrations.
It looks like this may now be growing into a nationwide movement, because every time one of these protests has been broken up, it's simply inspired more demonstrations on more campuses right across America.
Protests have spread to universities right across the US. From Yale on the East Coast, where almost 50 students were arrested last night, to California State University Humboldt, where students barricaded themselves inside a building and the police were sent in to remove them. Calling the cops is a highly controversial move on any campus, where students demand their right to protest. In New York, Columbia University has taken some classes online as campus protests continue there and looks set to carry on. Universities across the country are now braced for even bigger protests disrupting graduation ceremonies this summer.
Our North America editor Sarah Smith reporting. Still to come on this podcast, mass protests in Argentina over a de facto cut in university funding.
I'm Mark Lowen from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at divided opinions over the man leading 1.5 billion Catholics. Some see Pope Francis as too liberal, particularly on LGBTQ issues, while others see him as not progressive enough, especially after a recent document he signed condemning gender theory, reassignment and surrogacy. So how much of a reformer is he, and how woke is the Pope?
The police in Sydney have arrested 7 people as part of a counter-terrorism operation. The detentions follow a series of raids carried out by the Australian security forces in the aftermath of the stabbing of a bishop in a church last week. The police said the suspects, all aged under 18, were part of a network that shared a violent extremist ideology. They were, the police said, motivated by religion. Our correspondent in Sydney, Phil Mercer, gave me more details.
This is coming after raids on more than a dozen houses in Sydney and also in another community called Goulburn, which is on the way to Canberra here in Eastern Australia. Now, these 7 suspects are aged 15, 16 and 17, and the police allege that they follow this religiously motivated, violent extremist ideology similar to that of a teenager arrested following a stabbing at a church here in Sydney just over a week ago. That 16-year-old boy has been charged with terrorism offences. Now, these 7 teenagers, apparently under surveillance by the authorities, but the intelligence service here in Australia says that this group was such a danger to the community that they posed an unacceptable risk to the people of New South Wales, prompting these raids by more than 400 officers here in Sydney and in Goulburn.
And this extremist network they're in, is that all teenagers or is it a wider range of ages than that involved in it?
Well, investigators are stressing that they believe further raids and potentially further arrests will be made. So at the moment, it seems that we have an alleged cell made up of teenagers. Now, investigators believe that it was likely an attack may have been about to take place. No specific target has been identified, but the authorities do say that any alleged conspiracy is not linked to Anzac Day that takes place on Thursday that commemorates Australia's military veterans along with those from New Zealand or any other religious events. And Australia's national terror threat level remains at possible. This is the second lowest rating in a five-category system.
Anzac Day is certainly a big deal in Sydney. I've been there for it myself. And the police, as you say, are distancing any suggestion that this is anything to do with that.
Yes, and they say that it's targeting radicalisation, not religion. This is part of an investigation into a stabbing of a bishop and three other people at an Assyrian Orthodox church here in Sydney on Monday of last week. And that led to very serious disturbances outside of the church. And the authorities say that the investigation into that alleged act of terror has led them to today's raid in which seven teenagers have been arrested.
Our correspondent in Sydney, Phil Mercer. A British mining company is facing allegations of damaging both the environment and local communities in Brazil. The company, Brazil Iron, describes itself as a sustainable mining company and says it can be a world leader in making the steel industry greener. But dozens of local residents are launching a legal claim in a British court today, accusing the firm of damaging their health, crops and water supplies. Our South America correspondent Ione Wells has been to the site in Brazil.
I'm looking at the mine now. It's a huge hunk of grey amid a big sea of green in these mountains. Brazil Iron claim that it's uniquely placed here in Bahia to produce a certain type of iron pellet, which in turn can be used to make steel in a greener way that produces less carbon. Now, we all need steel. It's in our homes, our cars, our trains. So there's reasons to try and make it more carbon friendly. But the big question here is whether that's coming at the cost of the environment on the ground.
Socorro urgentemente.
Help, urgently. Who is asking you is the spring from which clear waters have always flowed.
This is a poem written by Catarina. She's a member of the Quilombola community here in Bahia, descendants of African slaves in Brazil whose land and way of life is protected under Brazilian law. They live a few hundred metres below an iron ore mine, where the British-owned company Brazil Iron was mining and now wants a licence to continue.
Walking through the riverbank now, which is completely dry. This river would have supplied the community with water, but also would have supplied her business, her lake, with water too.
This was a lake 3 meters deep, where we had a project to raise fish. After the mine started extracting there, waste came down, it fell into the spring. With that, it buried this entire lake. 3 more meters of silt and ore sludge, and our project went down the drain.
It's hard to believe that what I'm looking at now was once a lake that was meters deep, because now it is totally dry, but it is completely overgrown with vegetation. We're now at the house of Egemoni, who is a member of the Quilombola Bocaina community who live in the valley below where the mine is.
It was a respiratory issue with my daughter. She practically didn't sleep the whole night trying to scratch her throat. I had to take her to the doctor, who gave her an inhaler.
Not everybody here in the community is against the mine, though. Some feel that it's brought opportunities and jobs to the area.
Sou Erivelto, sou da comunidade Bocaina, município de Piatã.
This is Eri Velten. He works for Brazil Iron.
I joined the company in 2019. I had the opportunity to learn on heavy vehicles. Then I asked for the opportunity to learn machines. I think one of the main benefits that the company brought was the opportunity to live close to family. It is something that money can't buy.
The company is based far from here, in London, and funded by shareholders around the world. It says the allegations it faces are untrue and could hurt the local economy, but its environmental manager, Rafael Genu, says its doors are open.
All our monitoring indicates that the mine had no impact. We will have to check those water sources that have been dried up. It is an important point. There is an open communication channel with these communities that includes an ombudsman. The company always has its ears open.
The community here is divided, but this legal action centres around some members of the community, like local geographer Rogério Macuge, arguing those with a greener way of life shouldn't have to change to provide solutions for carbon emissions caused elsewhere.
Existem duas realidades.
There are two realities. Do we need to sacrifice everyone in rural areas for the city, where people have a 600-year-old way of life? I believe the communities here should be respected. If we're saying this model is sustainable, that will generate clean energy, is it clean to kill a river?
Rogério Macuge adding that report from Ione Wells in Brazil. Mass protests against budget cuts to higher education have swept the Argentine capital, Buenos Aires, and other cities, with students and professors saying funding for this year has in effect been reduced by some 80% because of the country's spiralling inflation. Bruno Laplaza is a student who went to Tuesday's demonstration. My colleague James Cotnell asked him to describe the scene.
Well, you would have seen a sea of students, professors, teachers, professionals, families, and people who were there defending our right to an education, to higher education. In Argentina, education has been public and free, free of access for everyone since the mid-20th century. And that's a right that we give for given. And it is not something that we're willing to lose. So that's what you would have seen. It was a very moving situation. Hundreds of thousands of people just protesting for one of the most valued human rights here.
And is that why you went? Because you are very concerned about your future, the future of the universities?
I'm a student. I'm a student of the University of Buenos Aires. Not only am I concerned for the future of universities, which I'm most certainly worried about. We do not know at this moment if we are going to be able to finish the semester, but I'm also worried about the future of my country. You know, education is fundamental for any plans of progress for a country, and the whole system of science is also fundamental, and it is also being defunded. So that is why I was there, because I believe that Argentina can progress, that we can be a better country, a more wealthy one, and that requires education for everyone.
The newish president, Javier Milei, has quite often suggested that these state-run universities are centres of socialist indoctrination, that in some ways the cuts are justified because so many at the universities have different viewpoints to him.
I mean, I think data speaks for itself. More than half of his cabinet comes from public universities. So, yeah, I would be at least puzzled by these statements. There's definitely a diversity of thought within public universities.
He came to office on a promise of making big cuts to almost all areas of the national budget, really. Why should universities escape from that?
Education is the base for progress. It is the base for a wealthy economy. It is the base that you need for an economy to industrialize and for economies to grow, right? There is no future for Argentina if we cut spending on university, on the people who are most likely to contribute the most to the economy. It is not one of the most expensive things that we have, and it is definitely one of the most rewarding things for the economy. So if we just focus on the economy, that is that. But there's also the value that it gives to society, right?
Bruno Laplata with my colleague James Copnell. Plato, known as the father of Western philosophy, died around the year 348 BC. Unusually for an ancient thinker, nearly all of his works have survived. The exact location of his burial has always been a mystery until now. With the help of artificial intelligence, Italian researchers claim to have found the long-lost grave of the Greek philosopher. Rebecca Wood has the story.
Wise men talk because they have something to say. Fools, because they have to say something. That's one of Plato's quotes, and one I'm hoping on this occasion the first part can apply. Arguably the greatest of all the Greek philosophers, Plato's works form the foundations of Western society. He was born a nobleman in ancient Greece, but rejected his social privilege to devote his life to philosophy. He wrote about love and government, ethics, friendship, law, and his writings set out the terms of much of what we call Western philosophy today. But, as with many illustrious figures of the ancient world, his burial place has been a subject of speculation. We know that he was buried at the Academy, a famous school founded by the philosopher in Athens. But the grounds are large, and exactly where was a mystery. Here's where some charred papyrus comes in, the Herculaneum scrolls. They survived the eruption of Mount Vesuvius in Italy in 79 AD. In their burnt state, though, the 2,000-year-old documents would crumble if anyone attempted to unroll them. But using computer technology and advanced artificial intelligence, researchers have been able to take a closer look. And it's this research by Graziano Ranocchia from the University of Pisa and his team that has pinpointed an exact location, a private garden in the academy near to a sacred shrine to the Muses. The team believe they'll have the whole of the papyrus analysed by 2026, so perhaps I should leave them with some apt words from the man himself. No one should be discouraged who can make constant progress, even though it be slow.
Rebecca Wood reporting. From Plato to Taylor Swift, whose fans have been flooding to a pub in London after it was name-checked in one of the songs on her new album. Staff at the Black Dog in Vauxhall think their pub is referred to in the song called The Black Dog. It was supposedly frequented by the singer when she lived in the British capital. And now, as Dan Simpson reports, it seems many Swifties are keen to follow in her footsteps.
And so I watch as you walk into some bar called the Black Dog and pierce new holes in my heart.
Mel, so I've stopped you because I saw you take a phone out. You were getting a picture of the Black Dog. Why is this so important to you?
Because I love Taylor Swift.
So when you heard the song, what went through your mind? Immediately ran down here?
No, we're actually in London from Canada, so we've travelled a long way and thought, well, if we're all this way, we've got to walk past the Black Dog.
What does her music mean to you?
We've come all this way so we can go to Lisbon and see her next month.
So you're en route?
We are en route to the Eras tour.
So this is a perfect stop-off for you?
It is indeed, yeah.
Lily, you work here at the Black Dog. Tell us about the last few days.
It's been crazy, to be honest with you, but super, super positive. And we've loved having all of the Swifties down. We've definitely seen an increase of people coming in. You know, the Taylor Swift effect is real. It's been positive vibes, though. We've had sing-alongs. We've got a couple of new menu items dedicated to Taylor going on. So, yeah, we're just loving it.
And then you need to work really quickly, right? Do you have a DEFCON 4 meeting? What can we do? Thousands of fans will be here.
Yeah, well, we're a small company, so thankfully we can act really quickly on stuff like this. So it was just a matter of getting the social media set up properly. You know, we launched a TikTok that now has nearly 2 million views, accumulative over about 4 or 5 videos. We've tripled our Instagram following. We've got merch dropping as well, which is really exciting. The Swifties are excited for, so definitely working around the clock for the next couple of days, I think, but we're loving it.
Well, she name-checked the track because it seems like she's been here. Do you remember any of this?
Yeah, I couldn't possibly confirm or deny, but we do have a certain blonde regular.
What do you do at that point? Because she's just such a star. It must be a big deal for you, but you want to kind of treat them like they're normal people.
100%. Everybody who walks into the pub is just a patron. We just want to serve them a good pint and, you know, a really good pub meal. And we're so thankful that this is facilitated.
How
how you don't miss me in the Black Dog when someone plays the star.
Dan Simpson reporting from the Black Dog in London. And that's all from us for now. There'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you'd like to comment on this edition and the stories we included, drop us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. Or on X, we are at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chris Hansen. The producer was Oliver Berlau. The editor is Karen Martin. My name's Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
I'm Mark Lowen from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at divided opinions over the man leading 1.5 billion Catholics. Some see Pope Francis as too liberal, particularly on LGBTQ issues, while others see him as not progressive enough, especially after a recent document he signed condemning gender theory, reassignment and surrogacy. So how much of a reformer is he, and how woke is the Pope?